It's the Nocturnal Journal. And this is Chris Jones with Mark Carrow here between 9 and 11, bringing you the Nocturnal Journal. We were here 2 weeks ago. You thought that was it. Yes, you thought it was a one-time
only. No one thought that. they all thought, when are they coming back?
One time only. We're back.
When are they going to bash down the doors and force their way into the situation?
Incredibly. Carrow and Jones are back for 2 hours with you this Saturday night on Labor Day.
We've already been called the buddy cop movie of talk shows.
That's what we are.
On radio.
So here we are. It's Labor Day weekend, Mark Carrow. A weekend for me, always with a tinge of melancholy. The end of summer.
It is.
The beginning of seriousness. Why is it? Why does everything get serious after Labor Day? I have to put my white pants away and everything.
I know. You look very jaunty in your... Actually, you look kind of serious in your white pants. It's kind of scary, though, because you have to carry your beer more carefully. But... yeah, I don't know. There's certainly that sense in the movies where, like, all of the good movies this summer seem to be things that were sort of counter-programming, but it's like, oh, everyone's out of school. You know, those of you parents, you're trying to figure out what to do with your kids all the time. And, I mean, my kids already started school, and so there is the sense of, oh, I can get back to work now. There's regular schedule going on here. But at the same time, I don't know. I don't want everything to be serious now.
So the plan... Folks, for the next couple of hours is to sort of celebrate the end of summer a little bit. Talk about some of the big issues we've got going. We're going to talk about Labor Day. This summer, we're going to talk about Tribune Tower. Yes, we are, because we are fearless at the Nocturnal
Journal.
That's
right. We both spent some time in Tribune Tower. We're spending time in there right now,
as we speak. We'll talk about the future of where we sit. We're going to pay a little tribute to the great Gene Wilder. And we're going to talk a little bit about Guaranteed Rate Park.
What is that? It doesn't sound like a stadium on the south side thing.
So we have a bunch of things to talk about. We're going to talk about taco trucks. We're going to talk about summer, as I mentioned. We're going to talk about food. We got it all going on. We hope you will join us.
Spoiler alert! You need to say spoiler alert before you give all those things away,
it's just
Chris.
So
I mean, why are people? You know,
you won't want to. You just you know right now
taco trucks. You know, one of these days there's going to be one on every street corner, I'm afraid.
I'm imagining our listeners right now maybe pulling over to the side of the road. I'm imagining somebody on I-94 heading to Milwaukee or maybe the Dells with the kids in the back.
No, they're there already. It's the Saturday night of Labor Day. They're not on their way to the Dells now.
Maybe you're missing the traffic. Maybe you're going for the last couple of days.
I just heard listen to David Jennings' report. So, no traffic right now. Good time to be driving and listening to us, huh?
So that's what we're gonna sort of do. So let's talk a bit about summer. What did you do this summer? What are your fondest memories of the summer, Mark Carrow?
I like water. You know, I went to a pool today, and it's just lovely getting in water when it's nice, and I like doing that. Last time we talked about my adventures up in northern Wisconsin. That's always a good thing to do. But you, on the other hand, you are sort of the counter-programming master.
That's me.
You zag when people zig. Where did you just go, Mr. Chris Jones?
I just went to Colombia. Yes, indeed, Colombia, the country of Colombia, to Cartagena for a lovely family vacation, a very sort of, you know, I guess it's counterintuitive. It's actually a fantastic city. It's a walled city, historic city, with the most beautiful, wonderful, lovely people I've ever met. And we just had the best time. Nothing is too expensive, which I like because I'm cheap. I like if I'm on a jet ski, I like that jet ski to be no more than $40.
Well, there
$40 an hour. You beat that on Lake Geneva, friends. You may not. So it's a really, really great place. And, you know, one of the great things about it was the plethora of vendors. It's like vendor heaven. Everything is available. Everything arrives at you. And I think I have my ultimate vendor story, and this is my ultimate vendor story.
Chris, what is your ultimate vendor story?
I was in a restaurant, an Italian restaurant, and I'm a little beyond my first blush of youth, and my eyes are not as they were. And I'm in the dark restaurant. I get my iPhone out. I turn on the flashlight on my iPhone. I'm still trying to read the menu. I'm like, God, I can't see this menu. Through the open window of the restaurant appears a vendor, yes, dangling a pair of reading glasses. So then I thought, what is this guy's business model? He must go around to every restaurant, find a guy who can't read the
He's like, this looks like a dude who needs some reading glasses right now.
And all of a sudden, there he was. But it was like a moment. It was like, oh, I can't read it. And then there were the glasses. I thought it was the most, I bought him because I was like, that is the coolest thing I've ever seen.
How much did you buy him for?
Well, you know, I got him down. He started at 20. I think.
So you had like this long, in the middle of dinner, you had this long negotiation with a guy to buy reading glasses so you could read the menu?
I was just so impressed. impressed that there were the reading glasses. I'm like, how did you know? It was the moment I couldn't read the menu.
You know how he knew? Because you were at an Italian restaurant in Colombia. You know, I think they just wait for the Americans to go to the Italian restaurant in Colombia instead of like the nice little fish seafood place that's, you know, looking out on the water.
But it was like they dangled in front of my eyes. It was like it was almost like a prayer. It was like there they were. How could you not buy those?
Are you wearing them now?
I am wearing them.
Is that what you're wearing right now?
Right now.
They had the sticker on
them. They did have the sticker on them.
Until I said, why is the sticker on the front of your glass lens? It says it was in English, so. Well, anyway,
okay,
congratulations. So I'm glad the highlight of your summer was getting reading glasses in an Italian restaurant in Colombia. And what I was going to say was that, again, the counterintuitive part is that you know, a lot of people, they think I'm going to go to a country like that when it's cold out, not when it's the most beautiful weather in Chicago. But on the other hand, that's when you're able to do it. And it wasn't quite crazy hot, is this what
No,
you're
it was really nice. It's a nice breeze. It was about as perfect a thing as you could possibly have. You know, the other thing that I noticed there, I was really struck by just the scale of national mourning that existed over the loss of, you know, Juan Gabriel, one of the great superstars of the Latin world. This was just last week. It was Sunday, I believe. And I was there, and it was as if the country stopped. Everybody, that guy, although, you know, certainly made the news in Chicago and certainly in New York, but you had to be in Colombia to really see just what a superstar that guy was.
Yeah, there was one of those news stories where, on some level, it was sort of reported like this is an important guy, but there are a lot of people like myself who don't really know his music particularly. But you could also tell that this was like a Prince-level, you know, death for a lot of people. And he was scheduled to play in Chicago on September 25th. He's going to be at the Allstate Arena. So, that you know, that's a big place in Chicago for him to play as well. So obviously he was big here as well. But to be there is pretty interesting.
So if you were a Juan Gabriel fan, you want to give us a call and talk about him, 312-981-7200. Baseball fans, the Crosstown Showdown may be over, but who are the greatest Chicago baseball players of all time? Visit chicagotribune.com/greatest and vote for Chicago's Baseball All-Stars, presented by Wintrust. Chris Jones and Mark Carroll will be right back. Me enamoré. Perdona si te causo dolor. How I long to feel that summer in my heart. How I long to feel that summer. We're back. It's Chris Jones and Mark Carroll, the greatest substitute teachers in radio history, filling in for Dave Hoekstra on the Nocturnal Journal. You can join the conversation on our Twitter handles at Mark Carro, MarkCarro, and at Chris Jones Trib, which is pretty obviously spelled. Mark Carro, what is this rather hypnotic, weird song we're playing?
Oh,
here
this
for
is
our
great.
Listener?
We're introducing WGN listeners to Gorky Zygotic Minky. MYNCI. They're a wonderful Welsh band, and they do these. They have some really gorgeous songs. This is great. Listen, I'm just going to listen to this for a second. And the days
were so long. So melancholy, Mark Aron.
Well, it's Labor Day weekend. Is it? Yeah. The days are so long, and the days are so strong, and the nights are so. I'm just completely misquoting it now, but it's a beautiful song. How I long to feel that summer in my heart, which I think we're all feeling right now because it's Labor Day weekend. And so we feel like the summer's over. And yet, is this not the most beautiful, spectacular
Fantastic.
Weekend there is? And there are two more days. So don't get melancholy yet, especially not while listening to us. But Gorky Zygotic Minky is how they pronounce it, but it's spelled different. They're Welsh. They're kind of wacky, but they also have some beautiful songs. So they're not a sponsor of this show, but I like them.
I may take my first dip of the year in the lake Because I traditionally do that on Labor Day. Because by Labor Day, it is actually of a temperature where I don't immediately run out of the
room. I hate to tell you, but it was of a temperature that was really nice about a month ago, too. It's been nice.
Enough.
No, it's good. Because the water warmed up early. It was in the mid-70s. It's been great.
It's a Labor Day tradition for me. I get my little pad, jump in the lake.
That's fine. Chris Jones, you do the things the way you're going to do them, and no one's going to convince you otherwise, and that's just fine. So, you know, we've all enjoyed the lake before Labor Day, and we'll be happy to see you out there while the lifeguards are there for two more days.
So, you know, here we are, Mark Carroll, Chris Jones, in for Dave Hoekstra on the Nocturnal Journal. You were reading about this fascinating question from our political discourse that sort of got into the food area.
You were talking about all your food vendors.
My food vendors.
And this is sort of the week for food vendor news, right? Because you had, all right, I don't know how large a group this is, but... you do have this guy, Marco Gutierrez, who is a founder of Latinos for Trump.
Yeah.
And he was on MSNBC, and he was saying, he was talking about, you know, after, you know, Donald Trump gave this speech about immigration that you all know about. He went to Mexico and then came back, and then he had some, you know, steam coming out of his ears and was talking. And he said, if you don't do so, Gutierrez, who supports Trump, was talking about, he said, my culture, being Mexican, is a very dominant culture, and it's imposing and it's causing problems. If you don't do something about it, you're going to have taco trucks on every corner. To which the Twitterverse responded, great. When are the taco trucks coming?
That's what I said.
And I didn't actually see an official response, but I'm imagining the Illinois Restaurant Association went, no, they're not brick and mortar. We need brick and mortar taco places, not taco trucks. And so, because, you know, we fight about these things here in Chicago, and we also like tacos.
Well, there's this fascinating question is just how many street corners are there? When you say a taco truck on every corner, you're talking like, depending on how you define corner, you're talking about 400,000 billion corners.
The idea of that being the threat is just sort of funny, though, because like a lot of people like tacos. So Steve Lopez in the LA Times, he wrote, well, here in Los Angeles, we can tell the rest of the nation what it's like. First of all, it smells really, really good all the time. Let's say you can't sleep and you roll out of bed and decide you're hungry, but it's 2 a.m., no problem. Open a window, take a deep breath, and follow the scent of sizzling meat, onions, and peppers to the nearest taco truck. Taco trucks are like palm trees here, part of the landscape and not hard to find.
It is rather like my reading glasses that arrived through the window. It's the taco equivalent of a pair of reading glasses.
Well, again, we don't want to get political here on the Nocturnal Journal, All right. Well, I could be sort of passive aggressively political is what I'm trying to do subtly, but you're calling me out on it. This whole sort of immigration question and this fear of taco trucks makes you think that if, you know, a certain Republican candidate wins, the food is going to be really terribly boring because there's really a lot of great food in this country. And a lot of the reason is because of immigrants. And I don't know about you, but I like going to all the different ethnic foods.
I
would love to have taco trucks on every corner. That would be great.
So I'm going to put you on the spot. He doesn't know what I'm going to say.
I don't.
I'm totally on the spot. Okay, you ready? So what is your single favorite present Chicago food truck? If you could have one food truck on the Mark Carroll corner, which truck would it be?
Okay, tweet me now on how much money you'll give me to mention you, and I will. Now, you know what? You know, so back by the Tribune, they didn't come by as much anymore. But I always liked the Fat Shallot. They have this crazy BLT. And I'm not even like much of a bacon guy, and I'm also uncomfortable with that David Jackson, Gary Marks series. You know, it confirmed a lot of my feelings about bacon.
Right.
But the BLT that the Fat Shallot serves, it's just a lot of crispy bacon with like avocado and some aioli and some, I think it's a truffle aioli and some basil. So it's kind of, you know, fancy BLT, but that's really, really good.
You know, I don't feel that Chicago is over food truck, do you? I mean, it feels to me, I mean, just been
no,
to Cartagena.
No, I think
there's a lot more food on the street.
Look, the Sun-Times just did a really, you know, great job, and they worked on this in conjunction with ABC Channel 7, and they were talking about how few of the food trucks are adhering to these rules that are in place, and so Mayor Emanuel then responded and said we're going to have to enforce the laws better.
No.
But at the same time, I just don't think you really feel inundated with food trucks, and I think that there's a general feeling, certainly among the food truck vendors, that the Illinois Restaurant Association and the city administration are more skewed toward brick and mortar restaurants, and I love brick and mortar restaurants too. We, you know, I tend to be of the not a zero sum game way of looking at things and think the more the merrier. Sometimes it's nice to go to a food truck. Sometimes it's nice to go to the food court, or sometimes it's nice to go to the restaurant.
Never let it be said that Mark Caro is not in favor of brick and mortar restaurants.
Don't say that. Brick and mortar.
You can find him.
Brick without mortar I'd even be okay with, or wood. Any of those restaurants are fine. And I just stayed at a place in Evanston, La Cochinita, which is a brick-and-mortar version of a food truck. That was a Venezuelan, I think it is, food truck, and they have tacos and arepas, which I probably should roll my
eyes. I was eating those in Cartagena.
Cartagena, exactly. So, while people were dangling reading glasses in front of your face.
The greatest vendors on the planet. I love a vendor who can just target the market. It's just a fabulous thing.
But yeah, so those, but you know, the food truck rules, like one of the rules is that you can only be there for 2 hours at a time. But then, you know, if you're sort of firing up a grill, then are you open for 2 hours, or, you know, can you get going? I mean, there are just like a lot of rules on them, and they're limited spaces. And certainly right out here behind the Tribune Tower, in front of the NBC Tower, I wrote about this for the Tribune. You would just have these trucks showing up at like 8 a.m. and trying to get in position because there's only room for two.
Jockeying
for a spot, and they really weren't near any restaurants particularly, and there was room for plenty of them. But if they didn't get in there, someone from the NBC Tower was going to come out and tell we were going to call the police, and it wasn't really a police matter, but it wasn't. And I mentioned this to someone from the city, and they're like, what do they care? That's what someone from the city said to me. But so it's hard. It's really hard operating a food truck. It's also hard operating a restaurant. I mean, the food business is just tough. So I understand all the sides of it, but the more the merrier. And certainly there are other cities you go to and you see more food trucks, including Cartagena, it sounds like.
Vendor capital of the world. I think I heard Mark Caro say the word Tribune Tower. We're going to talk more about Tribune Tower and the future thereof when we return from our commercial break. You are listening to The Nocturnal Journal with your guest substitute teachers, Mark Caro and Chris Jones. We'll be right back. Don't go away. And it seems such a waste of time. If that's what it's all about, Mama, if that's moving up, then I'm moving out.
Welcome back to the Nocturnal Journal. You're listening to Mark Caro, that is I, and Chris Jones.
Hello.
That is he, theater critic of the Chicago Tribune and former Chicago Tribune guy who already was moving out. But a lot of other people
moved
are...
out.
Actually, he doesn't really sing that with a stutter. I don't know why I did that. Billy Joel does not do that. I like it, though. We should just sort of do a My Generation version of moving out. Sort of like moo and oink, it sounds like, actually. But anyway, I hope someone appreciated the moo and oink reference here. Thank you very much. So, yeah, there's a little bit of hand-wringing around these parts. We're sitting here in the Tribune Tower right now. We could look over Michigan Avenue. This is a lovely address. This was a lovely place to work for 26 years, although I was out in the Orland Park Bureau for a little bit, and I'll tell you the tower was nicer. Chris Jones works here right now. And yet this week there was a lot of hand-wringing over the future of Tribune Tower and the future of the Chicago Tribune in it and all the journalists who enjoy working here. Is this just, Chris Jones, is this just journalists who, you know, just they don't want to adapt and they're nostalgic and they think things haven't changed and they're like, we just should get to stay here? Are they just being unrealistic?
Well, that is certainly the position of our esteemed architecture critic, Mr. Blair Kamen, with whom I have an enormous beef. And I have this opportunity now to take this up with him because he has a big column coming in tomorrow's Chicago Tribune,
he has a Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah, he does, but that doesn't mean he's right in this particular instance. And he starts his column off with one of those. You recognize this because you did this yourself on a number of occasions. Mm-hmm. Some colleagues say, "Well, I'm just saying." When you read that in the Tribune tomorrow, that some colleagues, he actually says, some colleagues have sidled up to my cubicle and tried to persuade me to make the case that the journalist should stay in the Tribune Tower. I'm here to say that some colleagues right here, Chris Jones.
At least one of them.
One of them.
You are a sidler.
I did sidle up. And he basically kicked me out of the cube. And he said, you're not a realist. He basically said, and this is the point he makes in his column tomorrow, that buildings are what matter. They're essentially that, you know, journalists don't get a pass on historical change. As we all know, the Tribune Media has sold the Tribune Tower to a CIM group and the Golub and Company, two developers, who are going to turn this beautiful tower, it appears, into a combination of hotel, condos, maybe some offices, and clearly some retail. And there's a lot of sort of mishigas about where this retail will be. And, you know, there's this whole business with the view to the south of the building.
Right. And just to jump in really quick with some background. Which is, this is stuff that Chris and I have lived with, as well as many other of our, all of our colleagues. Through the storied history of the Tribune, there have been a lot of ownership. There's been much ownership drama. And one of the later developments was that after the 4 years of bankruptcy that we all quite enjoyed, Tribune Company was, it was one big company, and the larger Tribune Company decided to split it into two other companies, one of them being Tribune Publishing, which was just the newspapers,
right,
and the other one being Tribune Media, which is everything else, including the radio
station,
which
is the one
which
sold,
you're hearing
which is the one
us right now.
The building, right.
So what happened at that point was that the Chicago Tribune, once that happened, the Chicago Tribune newspaper and the newspaper group was paying rent to, in fact, another company. So even though Tribune Tower is named after the
right.
glorious Chicago Tribune, it was a different landlord. So the fact that Tribune Media then sold it, Tribune Media has no skin in the journalism game anymore because they already spun off the newspapers.
Well, in the print journalism game,
the print journals, right? TV, right? So they
correct.
Own all these TV yeah. stations, but the print journalism and the TV stations aren't exactly known for journalism.
I think
right?
you know. I think for most listeners, most people in Chicago really appreciate the beauty of that building. I think the central question here is whether it can be appreciated without the newspaper in it. Now, there's lots of examples of beautiful buildings that once hosted newspapers that no longer do, and this lobby of this tower, as you well know, Mark, is one of the most beautiful places to go in Chicago. Tourists come in every day. They stare up. They look at the outside.
I love walking into the office lobby. And having to get past people taking pictures.
It's the most beautiful lobby. It has the great inscriptions. It's one of the great sources of pride in Chicago. And the thing about it, if you're a journalist, is it elevates your game. It says to you, what you do matters. It elevates that. And Blair acknowledges that in this piece tomorrow. The fact is, that my argument with him, I guess, is that he's been on record a lot about facadectomies. That's a phrase that he's used where he doesn't like buildings where you keep the facade and you build a new building behind it. Fair enough. I say you take away the journalists, you have essentially a facadectomy. You've got the building but without the soul. I was just suggesting to him when I sidled up to his cubicle that it might be nice if you have a nice prestigious hotel or a nice prestigious condo, it might be nice to go, oh, there's a little journalist working downstairs. This is sort of the way it works in New York, in the New York Times building. To some degree, where you've got the Times on one floor and other people are the tenants in that building, like the building because they get to be in the same building. I'm arguing, and you know that wouldn't be a bad idea. He would say, you know, get with the Times, Chris Jones. Ridiculous.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, and also like Howls and Hood is the large restaurant that opened here a few
yes.
years ago, and they have a lovely outdoor space and a lot of indoor space. And what was striking to me was that. A, they named the place Howls and Hood. Why? Because that's the names of the architects of this building. And B, when you go in there, all of the decor, the whole feel of that place is basically the Tribune Tower lobby. And instead of having quotes about journalism, it has other quotes. But the whole feel of it is a tribute to the tower, its architects, and the fact that it houses the Chicago Tribune. And so there are echoes of that in there. Now, will Howells and Hood exist there? I have no idea what their lease situation is or anyone's lease situation with the place getting sold. But there is a sense that Howells and Hood is trying to reflect upon the fact that the Tribune is there. And I agree with you. I think that looking at the Tribune Tower and saying this is where Chicago Tribune is, at the central key location of Chicago, right by the river and the new Apple store.
And where WGN Radio is.
Where WGN
exactly.
Radio is, which stands for World's Greatest Newspaper.
Exactly.
That is fantastic. But the reality of it is also that it's a different company that owns it, that doesn't care
right.
about our nice Chicago Tribune newspaper because they cut us off. And they didn't let us keep the building. They took the, they kept the building, but that cut us off. And, you know, after that, they, you know, we're paying, the newspaper's paying rent. So can the newspaper afford to pay rent to this new, like, look, if these new owners came in and they were getting a lot of money from the Tribune to stay there, they're not going to turn down money, but they probably can make more money not having the Tribune in there. And the Tribune probably can save more money not being in there. And that's sort of the economic reality. But yes, it does become a facadectomy. Like, oh, this is where the Chicago Tribune used to be. And now you can go, you know, stay in a suite where Chris Jones used to write his wonderful Sunday column.
Well, one of the other fascinating things, of course, is that the tower isn't just a tower. There's the tower, which is a which is protected by landmark laws. And then there are these smaller buildings built for this radio station directly to the north of it
right.
that are not protected by a landmark and are likely to WGN now is now, of course, in the main tower, but those other buildings are likely to be turned into retail. One of the other questions going on is, will you know, is it advisable to have retail right on the south side of the building? Now, if you know Michigan Avenue, oh dear listener, you'll probably know that you have a fantastic view of the Tribune Tower as you walk across the bridge on Michigan Avenue. And there's this sort of question going on about, is it appropriate to sort of, should that view be protected? That should you be able to cross the river, cross the Chicago River, and have an unencumbered view of the facade of Michigan
right.
Avenue?
What's the point of a landmark building if you can't see it?
If you can't see it.
Right.
That's
right. And this is true from the east, from Lakeshore Drive
that's
as
right.
well. You can see it. This Ogden Corridor, is that what it's
called? Ogden Slip.
Ogden
that's
Slip,
right.
Which I didn't even know about, but I did know that you could see it.
Right. Who even knew it?
But, you know, where we parked the car, you know, that surface lot has been there, and you're like, you know, there aren't a lot of surface lots around here anymore. I mean, almost everyone,
that's right.
you know, along Illinois, along Grand, I mean, those are all gone. And you figure that's going to be gone at some point.
Well, and the other reality is that the Apple Store is coming to the Pioneer Court area right directly south of Tribune Tower, right by the Chicago River. In fact, if you walk by there tonight, or if you walk by on your Labor Day weekend, you can see the construction. So in other words, where an Apple Store goes, if you compare it to the one, for example, by the Plaza Hotel in New York, which is also a mostly subterranean Apple Store, that will create enormous interest. So what you've seen over the last few years, I think, Mark, is that the energy on Michigan Avenue has moved south. And so you've ended up with sort of this really epicenter, Pioneer Court, which is right outside WGN's beautiful Showcase studio, has become almost the town square of Chicago now. And I think once you've got the Apple Store in there, you know, the Wrigley Building's across the street, that's going to be so, so hot. And the reality, I'm probably just an old sentimental journalist. I should shut up.
It's sort of a redundant thing, though, because we all are. Journalists are the most sentimental, you know, as we report on moving forward and progress, we're also like,
No, don't change.
Don't.
We
love
kick
this.
Us out. So, yes, you know, Blair's probably right. You know, the building, what matters now is the preservation of that building. I just, forgive me if I shed a tear for the fact that a great building like that is built. It was all about the craft of journalism. And I would like to see this radio station in there, and I would like to see the Chicago Tribune in there.
If I own the building, I would definitely leave.
You'd buy it for me.
Yeah, you're right. I would, like, well, I'll ask you one more quick question.
Yes.
How much of a difference has being in the Tribune Tower meant to your journalism?
Well, I think it puts a certain spring in your step when you go into that lobby, and I think that actually does make a difference. I think that, you know, it elevates the purpose of news. If the whole idea of, you know, we all get into this business to sort of hold the powerful accountable in some way, and that can be a bit of a, you know, I guess a muckraking job in a lot of people's minds. And I understand why people feel that. I understand why that image is the way it is. But there's something about the elegance of that building. I don't find it a fussy building. I just think it just sort of raises everybody's game. And it reminds everybody that this is a crucial protection of democracy, that without journalists, you would have rampant corruption. And God knows in Chicago, we are familiar with that.
Well, I agree with you, and we're going to keep... There we go, our house. We are coming right back. We're going to go to commercial. We will be back with more discussion of this, and if you want to join the conversation, call us at 312-981-7200. My mum, she's so house proud. Nothing ever slows her down, and a mess is not allowed.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going down, down.
We're working the Nocturnal Journal right now. It's not really a coal mine here in the Tribune Tower, but we're up here on the seventh floor. It's Mark Caro here with Chris Jones.
Howdy.
You should tweet to us, by the way. Chris is at Chris Jones Trib, and I am at Mark Caro. That's M-A-R-K-C-A-R-O. You could tweet us questions. You could also call us at 312-981-7200. And we were discussing working in this coal mine, which is really not a coal mine at all. It's a lovely building. And I was asking Mr. Jones about how much this impacted his journalism. And he was talking about very lyrically and eloquently about, you know, the sort of the feeling, the elevated feeling you get walking in here.
Yeah.
But, you know, I will go back to the original question and the point, which is that we are journalists and we could actually do our work anywhere. I love being in this location because it's just so close to things and you get a great sense of things. And it does fill you with pride walking into a great building and feeling like you're part of this tradition. And the quotes on the wall downstairs are fantastic. But, you know, our job is sitting at desks on phones or even better, taking our little reporter's notebooks and getting out of the building and doing the work. And the best work that you have done is not sitting in the office. It's going to the theater and it's going to talk to people. And the best work I have done is going off to interview people and going off to find stories and everything. So aside from the symbolism, does it really matter what kind of office we are in? Or isn't that a 20th century notion?
I guess it is. Did you know? So Blair came in, the Tribune's Pulitzer Prize-winning architect critic, who I was just giving a very hard time.
Who didn't bother you at all with what he wrote.
No, he bothered me greatly. But however, I have to recognize his brilliance. And one of the reasons is he points out a couple of things in tomorrow's piece in the Tribune. He says that inside the lobby, and just listen to this, everybody. You've probably stood inside Tribune Tower lobby at some point in your life. I wonder if you've ever seen this. There is a sculpture of a whispering man whose fingers are pressed to his lips, and that symbolizes insidious rumor.
I did not know that. I read that too. I was like, wow. And then there's another one.
Another sculpted figure, his hands cupped to his mouth, who represents the clarion call. Great phrase. The clarion call of real news. So the point is that in this lobby, you have these two great sources of how journalists do their job. One is insidious rumor. When somebody in the Emanuel administration has some insidious agenda of their own, you need that. You need those sources to get that news. And at the same time, there is news that is shouted at you. You know, where the literally the clarion call of real news. And it's kind of brilliant that all those years ago, nearly a century ago, that architecturally those ideas of journalism could be built into a building. Now, that's great if you're living here and your condo is here and your bathtub is in, you know, it may be in the lobby, maybe you're buying the lobby. And there's, you know, the top of Tribune Tower is that fantastic what was basically the colonel's old hangout, and that's going to be, I'm guessing, a really cool condo for somebody,
or maybe it's a
restaurant. Maybe the Hausenhood will keep it.
You could get married up there right now. Hausenhood does have it right
don't
now.
Don't remind me.
Why? But no. Wait. Hold on a second. It's a lovely space. I mean, it's actually, you could rent it out. You could have a party up there. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, because the colonel was doing such elevated things
counting his money now.
I could go on and on in ways that maybe not even be appropriate for a radio audience about things that have gone on in the upper reaches of the Tribune Tower. It's not always the most elevated activity.
No, but I think what we're arguing a little bit about is to what extent a building is symbolized or to what extent a building lives or dies based on what goes on in there. And I think, you know, obviously history would suggest there are many, many buildings in the world that are now divorced from their original purpose. Or if you look at, for example, some of the great railroad terminals in the U.S. that have been turned into hotels, one in St. Louis is a great example,
right,
where you're just excited to be in that building. But I can't walk into that terminal without wanting to see a train. You know, now, me, railroads, newspapers, I know it's all nice. Not so much 21st century, it's not even properly 20th, but it's how I feel, that without the actual use of the space somehow, it becomes
a theme park.
Fraudulent.
It becomes a theme park a little bit.
It does.
But you know, at the same time, you can't have a railroad terminal there anymore, so what do you want to do with it? Just tear it down so it doesn't remind you that there was a railroad terminal?
No.
Or at least, you know, repurpose it in a way that, you know, people can appreciate the history of it.
Well, it's absolutely better to not, you know, I don't think anybody in Chicago would stand for the tower being sort of ripped up, or, you know, for it to be sort of, you know, in some way violated, particularly not that central cathedral-like structure. It's just too extraordinary a building. And that, for me, combined with the Wrigley Building across the street, that is Chicago for me. That is the sort of the epicenter of this city I've lived in for, you know, 25 years.
Right. A city that you adopted and made your home. And
exactly.
Obviously you've spent a lot of time at this nexus. I mean, this is where you work, so you take it personally.
So I take it personally. So there it is. You know, what can I say? I'll get through it. I'll get through it. You know,
again,
I'm just saying.
I'm sure if Blair could choose, he would choose to have us stay also.
Well, he should be making that argument then, shouldn't he? He's not making that argument.
Well, what he is doing is he's defending the integrity of the building.
And, yes, he's doing
and what
his
he
job.
Is doing is taking the long view of at some point. Given the economics, given the split of the company, given the way things are, I mean, if you're a newspaper in a struggling media environment, would you choose to spend more money on the rent in a historic building or more money on, say, reporters and travel budgets?
Well,
and that
but symbolism. I'm just arguing that symbolism is very important.
I agree with
symbolism
you.
Symbolism is very important.
But someone has to pay for the symbolism.
Well,
so that's a question. If someone, you know, if you had someone who could pay for it, I think everyone would be happy with it. And someone should pay for it because it is important. But my saying that someone should pay for it doesn't mean someone's going to pay for it.
I think we can all agree that there should not be retail, and this is certainly Blair's position, I think, there should not be retail directly south of Tribune Tower. That notion of walking up Michigan Avenue and seeing the facade of the building should be sacrosanct.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the design will be key in that, but if you could preserve Pioneer Court and if you could preserve the view, and again, that whole Ogden, you know, that the fact that you
Ogden
can see
Slip,
it all
yeah.
the way from Lakeshore Drive, I really appreciate it, but it never sort of occurred to me that was an intentional thing. That's one of the things, that, by the way, that drives me crazy about the Trump building, because I actually like the Trump building except for that
spire.
It's
a good building. Yeah.
But then when they put his name on it, what it did was that it ruined, because one of the, because what's, this is something that reading Blair made me appreciate, actually, is that views of buildings, it's different depending, like the view from Trump Tower from Michigan Avenue, it looks sort of, it's sort of fat at the bottom and it's a little bit strange, but the really great view is if you're on Wabash and you look up Wabash and then there it is, and it was a really elegant view you would get, and now you see that name, and especially now in these certain,
politicized,
you know, political, but even before, just seeing the name, it just ruined it.
It just messed up
their view.
You know,
so you want to have the view of Tribune Tower preserved.
You see a lot of tourists who get a surprise. I was actually standing with a visitor who'd never been to Chicago before, and they were sort of, they did a double take. They looked up Wabash Avenue, and they saw, all they can see, of course, is the name of the building. And they did a kind of a double take on it. You know, I think people are actually surprised. And then I got into a whole debate over which buildings are allowed names on them. And that, as you well know, Mark, is a complicated, you know, a lot of political history in Chicago on which buildings get names. But, you know, we can all agree that it's a pity that that one is there, I think.
Well, I'm going to throw this to commercial. I did want to mention, though, that I did see John Anderson from Yes perform solo in the crown of the Tribune Tower in the
What year was that?
It was when Lee Abrams was here with the Sam Zell thing, and he brought him in, and we had a little drawing. No, he opened it up for everyone. But so I've seen John Anderson singing, "We have seen all good people," in the Tribune.
How many people?
Like 40, something like that. Like a drawing. I don't know how many people actually entered the drawing, but it was pretty cool. We're going to ads right now. We'll be back with Nocturnal Journal with Chris Jones and Mark Caro in a moment.
What's your name, little girl? What's your name? Shouldn't you stay, little girl? Won't you do the same?
We're back. It's the final hour of the Nocturnal Journal. I'm Chris Jones, critic, columnist at the Chicago Tribune, here with my pal Mark Caro.
Hey!
Mark is the host of the Music Box's Is It Still Funny series, coming up Wednesday night, 7:30. Harold and Maude, Is It Still Funny?
My favorite movie through college, and I haven't seen it since then.
And he has a fabulous new songwriting book. Yes, indeed. Take It to the Bridge, Unlocking the Great Songs Inside You. He's a man of many, many talents, Mr. Mark Caro.
Out Carroll. Soon, not out yet. Look forward to it, though.
So here at the Nocturnal Journal for just a few minutes, our final hour, we're going to talk about Gene Wilder, the great Gene Wilder, a little bit later on. If you want to, we're on a sort of a building kick at the moment. We were talking last half hour about the future of Tribune Tower. If you want to weigh in on that, you can call us at 312-981-7200. And we're going to turn our attentions and our attitudes now to yet another atrocity, shall we say, the renaming of the home of the Chicago White Sox as Guaranteed Rate Park. Guaranteed Rate Field. I get that right. Guaranteed Rate Field.
Yeah, it rolls off the tongue. That's why you're having
Guaranteed
so much
Rate Field.
Just,
so that, you know, there's been
so
a lot
natural
of,
to say that.
There's been a lot of talk on the Twitterverse. You know, what will be the nickname for this? What will be the nickname for the part? The Great, or maybe
Paul Sullivan, esteemed baseball writer of the Chicago Tribune, has been calling it the G Spot. He's lobbying for that.
Men wouldn't be able to find it.
Oh,
right here on the
it's
nocturnal.
It's Saturday night after 10 on WGN.
It's a Labor Day weekend, and you're
call
feeling
right
depressed.
Call right now, 981-7200 in the 312 area.
I have a little bit of a theory on this that I think is just, you know, and this is interesting to me, that, you know, it's not a news story for people to be upset by the renaming of beloved sports stadia.
Though this is the worst one ever.
Yeah, and here's perhaps why. Before I say why, it's also a reality now that these names don't last forever because, you know, you have to pay really a lot of money to get beyond about 20 years. Here's what I think is unusual about this. We've seen a trend of certain companies in the dot-com era of naming themselves really based on their product. So, in other words, it's like it's a sort of a dot-com thing. So Guaranteed Rate is a company that gives you a guaranteed rate on your mortgage. Ironically, the symbol is a downward arrow, which is probably less than
ideal. Yeah, it looks great. Looks great at the ballpark. Yeah, great.
Mark Caro, don't you think, you know, instead of the something is substantial, even U.S. Cellular Field was a company's name. This is, in effect, a slogan turned into a name.
Right. Well, what it is, I mean, if you look at it from the ballpark point of view, you could sort of see this general degradation. Did I pronounce that right? Yeah. Anyway, it just kind of keeps getting worse where really, you know, originally you just had parks named after names.
Individuals.
Might have been rich individuals, but they were individuals. Right. And then they were sort of companies like, you know, United Center. Like, okay, United
Wrigley Field, right?
Well, Wrigley is a guy's name who also owned
Both at once.
But like United at least is a nice word. Guaranteed Rate is just terrible. Because it just, and nothing against the company Guaranteed Rate. I'm not saying the company is bad. I'm not saying their work is bad. I'm not saying the people who work there are doing bad things. I don't know anything about it. But in terms of like it being a ballpark, I mean, American baseball is just, there's sort of a mythology to it. So I've been looking this up. I'm actually going to just, like, right now there are 10 baseball, nationally, Major League Baseball parks that do not have a corporate sponsored name. So there are 10. It's actually more than I would have expected. And they are, you want to name
them?
Do you know what they are?
No, you tell me.
I will tell you. They're Ewing Kauffman's. It's Kauffman Stadium in Kansas City for the original owner, Ewing Kauffman.
Including individuals.
This is not corporate.
Okay,
right.
Got it.
There's Marlins Park, Turner Field in Atlanta.
Yeah.
There's Yankee Stadium. That's pretty straightforward, right? Fenway Park.
Might want to keep that.
Wrigley Field, Oriole Park at Camden Yards, Dodger Stadium, Angel Stadium of Anaheim, and Nationals Park. So there are 10 of them. And
are you saying there should be more, or what are you saying?
I'm saying that those at least have your classic, you know, ballpark names. Now, there were other ones like, you know, Three River Stadium and Riverfront Stadium, and those have given way to, you know, less lyrical things like PNC Park in Pittsburgh and, you know, instead of Three River Stadium. And, you know, you have Petco Park in San Diego, which replaced Qualcomm Stadium, which the Chargers are still at. You have Safeco Field. You have a lot of, you know, banks and insurance, a lot of insurance. Globe Life Park in Arlington. It was the ballpark at Arlington.
But Mark, are you saying that these are private?
These are all
businesses. Let me ask this question.
These
are all businesses.
Yes.
Should they not? Why? How can you sit there and say, well, you know, you have no right to take the highest bidder. It's a private entity. Guaranteed Rate came in, made the right deal. You know, why shouldn't Jerry Reinsdorf take that deal? Why? Does he have some moral obligation to name the stadium to your liking or in some romantic way? Isn't that the same argument we were making about the Tribune? You were saying you were calling me sentimental at that point.
Okay, so let's say Tribune, let's say that Uber became the corporate sponsor of the Tribune Tower. Would you call it Uber Tower?
Groupon.
Would you call,
Groupon.
Whatever.
Tower.
Whatever it is. Are you gonna not? Is it not going to be Tribune Tower in your name? I mean, this is sort of this just gets into a more existential question, Chris Jones, about what is the nature of names? You know, the Sears Tower isn't the Willis Tower, now it's something else. So I used to go to this, you know, music venue in Tinley Park. It was never a great place to see a concert, but it's not a terrible place to see a concert. It's, you know, it's an outdoor venue. You know, you had you still have Alpine Valley, lyrically named Alpine Valley. You used to have Poplar Creek, and then you had the World Music Theater. The World Music Theater then became the New World Music Theater because they made some improvements and changes onto it. And then it became the Tweeter Center because Tweeter was an electronics store company. Tweeter doesn't exist anymore. So that became the First Midwest Bank Amphitheater, not to be confused with First Merit Bank Pavilion at Northerly Island. Now it's the Hollywood Casino Amphitheater, not to be confused with the Hollywood Casino, which is in Joliet. Now, are you, as a patron of concerts, required to keep up with what the latest corporate name is because someone keeps spending more money on these things? Or can you just decide, I'm just going to call it the World, or I'm going to call it Tribune Tower or Sears Tower?
That's the thing
like
about names, right?
So maybe
a name has to be accepted, right? There's two levels of name. There's the name they want you to call it, and there's the name that people really call it.
Yeah, and it just, Guaranteed Rate. I mean, I could read you all of the, I could really bore you on this too, but I can read you all the ballpark names in baseball and football, and it's just blander and more. You know, I mean, there are a lot of bank ones too, and those are pretty bad. My line was that I was hoping that, you know, Fifth Third Bank sort of chimes in and helps pay for it, and then it could become Guaranteed Third Rate Field. But you know, do you have to call it Guaranteed Rate, or maybe you just start calling it Comiskey again? Not that everyone, you know, needs to love whatever, you know, Comiskey did, but I just feel like that was at least the name. I mean, it wasn't the name of that park because it's a rebuilt park. I don't know.
Well,
if
you have an opinion on this, you can give us a call on 312-981-7200. This is Chris Jones, Twitter Chris Jones Trib, and Mr. Mark Caro, at Mark with a K, C-A-R-O. Sunday at 1, the White Sox are tangling with the Twins, and then you can catch the Cubs in Milwaukee Monday at noon. You can watch all of the action this holiday weekend, this Labor Day weekend, on WGN-TV. This is Chris Jones with Mark Carroll, The Nocturnal Journal. We will be right back.
Like the pine trees lining the winding road, I've got a name, I've got a name.
10:20 p.m. WGN Radio. Saturday of Labor Day weekend. You've got 2 days left. You don't have to go to work on Monday. Two more days of summer. Here we are with the Nocturnal Journal with your substitute teachers, Mark Caro.
Hello.
And Chris Jones.
And Jim Croce.
Here with you till 11 o'clock. We're talking names. This half hour, we're going to talk Gene Wilder in just a few minutes, who we both greatly admire. More about that in a second. But we're talking
names. That was not
names
his original
right
name either, but that was a good name, Gene Wilder. Wilder Stadium would be a better name than Guaranteed Rate Field.
So we're complaining about Guaranteed Rate Field. We got into a sort of an existential thing on, like, you know, is this mere sentiment? And, you know, these are just places that get sold to the highest bidder. So, you know, if you've got an opinion on it, you know, you can reach us right here in the beautiful Tribune Tower. 312-981-7200. Chris Jones, Mark Caro here with the Nocturnal Journal. So, you know, is this just not something you can actually do anything about?
Well, I think that what you brought up is a good point, which is that sometimes just names now have just kind of gone downhill. I don't know. It's you know, so there's this. So this is, here's some more inside journalism baseball, since we already had some of it in the last hour. There's this phenomenon that a lot of people who are involved in the web know as SEO, search engine optimization. And what it does is it encourages you to have headlines that say exactly what something is about, like, you know, in George Clooney interview, as opposed to something clever, because it won't do well on Google or whatever else. And it's like a lot of these company names are sort of SEO type names,
right,
where guaranteed
you get
rate,
a guaranteed rate. I want a guaranteed rate
as opposed
on my mortgage,
to just
right.
being, you know, Thimble, or like Thimble would be a really great, you know, mortgage rate company. But, you know, there's just something about, you know, I mean, there were a lot of really terrible names when the dot-coms came around as well. You know, Qualcomm Field isn't exactly inspiring either. There's KFC Yum Stadium in Louisville also. And but that does not have a major, you know, that doesn't have a major league team
stakes
in it.
Stakes are less
high. But KFC Yum is
finger-licking good.
It's at least memorable. I think part of the guaranteed rate thing is that, again, nothing against even the White Sox. I like the White Sox, and I like everyone, but it's so bland. It's just not there. It's like the first Midwest Bank amphitheater. It's just, you know, there's just so the name of a someplace you're going to a place to have excitement. You know, a ballpark is like, this is going to be great, and you're like, I'm going to Yankee Stadium or Fenway Park or Wrigley Field, and even just by those names, they're associated with something that means something. And so to have a company that is not like a really storied company, and it's just words like guaranteed and rate. It just, the mythology's
gone. Well, I suppose on that deeper level, it's just that names that with the, in this SEO world, names, particularly in the corporate world, now have to be more practical, that you have to actually end up with a purpose, that the name, it's the same issue in headline writing, for example. There's a lost art now. The oblique headline, the sort of the nuance-driven headline has sort of gone the way of all flesh, it seems. Everything has sort of become practical.
The mythology has gone. We have a phone call, by the way. Should we take this call?
Let's take this call.
We got Rob who's calling. Let's hear from Rob.
Hello. How are you guys?
We're good. Thank you for listening.
But if you think about Wrigley Field, it's named after a product.
It's the guy's name, William Wrigley. I mean, I don't know.
He named the product after himself as well.
It's a fair point. Yeah.
But the guaranteed rate. We've already started trying to call it the great.
Right.
Yeah, good luck with that. There's a great. Nobody's going to call that the great park. They just aren't because we've been there.
But U.S. Cellular was awful. Everyone hated it.
Right.
But you call it the cell.
Right.
Well, there's a certain ironic, you know, in names that fans like, there's often like, it's kind of cool when the name actually subverts the original intent. You know what I mean? Like the cell is perfect for that.
But everyone on the South Side, like all of us, we always just called it Sox Park. Old Comiskey, New Comiskey. It's just Sox Park.
Right. Sox Park is maybe the way to go on that. And, you know, U.S. Cellular, everyone hated that. And then eventually people started calling it the cell, and that became accepted. But there was a pretty long learning curve for that to happen.
It just kind of grew into it, and it wasn't the worst thing ever the thing that you're going to call it.
How long did you say Rosemont Horizon instead of Allstate Arena?
I still want to call it the Horizon. I think I still do. And the UC is the UC.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
and that was never too bad.
Well, and the thing of it is, too, is that the UC was built as the UC, the United Center, as opposed to Chicago Stadium that was Chicago Stadium. They tore Chicago Stadium down, so they built something new and they called it that. It's when you rename things that already existed. I think that's where it starts getting thorny because you're like, wait, I got used to calling it this and I have to call it something else five times. I mean, the World Music Theater has had five different names and like the Hollywood Casino Amphitheater. And I'm like, oh, wait, no, that's the World. But I have to sort of stop and think about it now because I'll hear these Hollywood Casino ads and someone's coming there, and I'm thinking, wait, which place is that?
So, Rob, you're okay with it? You're okay with the great rate? You just thumbs up?
No, I'm just saying that's what's going around.
No, he's going to call it Sox Park. You didn't even call it the cell, did you?
You didn't even call it the cell.
Sounds good. Thanks for calling, Rob. Thanks for joining us on the Nocturnal Journal. We're talking about the scenario there at Sox Park in Rob's rationale.
Right,
anyway.
312-981-7200 if you want to be like Rob and join the conversation. Yeah, you know, just changing names so many times. And where do you draw the line? Again, would you call this, if the Wrigley Building, also named after, I mean, there was some talk about renaming Wrigley Field. And I think that, you know, they've certainly found other ways to make money off of that part.
They certainly have.
So they've done a very good job of it. And frankly, they've actually, the balancing act that they've done, I think that they've managed to still stay on the right side of fans. And having the best team in baseball doesn't hurt. But those, you know, the scoreboards, people, they're actually pretty functional, even though obviously it gives them new ad revenue opportunities. But I think that if they came in and said, you know what, from now on, you're not going to call it Wrigley Field. You're going to call it... You know, whatever whatever thing you want to call it. I don't want to make up a product and sound stupid. But if you could you know, come up with some, you know, product and name it, you know, some potato chip or something like that. You know, people are not going to want to call Wrigley that, and they would have a real problem with it. People still will not go set foot into Macy's because they changed the name from Marshall Fields. And it didn't matter who was owning Marshall Fields. As long as it's called Marshall Fields, Chicagoans would go into it. But once they called it Macy's, this city is not forgiving of changing names like that.
So one of our themes this show, it's the final weekend of summer. We're talking about sentiment. We're talking about nostalgia. And in the next half hour, we're going to talk about one of the great actors who we've lost, Mr. Gene Wilder. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is the Nocturnal Journal with Chris Jones and Mark Caro. Don't go away. Let's talk some Gene Wilder.
Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look and you'll see into your imagination. We'll begin with a spin, traveling in the world of my creation. What we'll see will defy explanation.
Welcome back to the Nocturnal Journal. I see a little tear rolling down the cheek of Chris Jones's face. Oh, Chris, it's okay. It's all right.
Leave is gone.
This is that is Chris Jones, theater critic and columnist extraordinaire of the Chicago Tribune, and this is Mark Caro, writer, cultural guy,
bon vivant,
host of the Is It Still Funny film series at the Music Box on seven on. I can't even talk. Wednesday show in Harold and Maude. See, it was easier when I would just say, you know, Chicago Tribune entertainment writer. But anyway, here we are at WGN. And Gene Wilder passed away. And, you know, it's interesting. There have been a lot of, you know, people have been basically saying that 2016 has been a tough year for living people we like. Right.
Right.
There's just been a lot of deaths. And Gene Wilder was 83, bless him. But this was one of those that sort of hit harder and closer to home for a lot of people than I think they would have thought. There was just a connection to him in a way that, you know, other celebrities of whatever stature you think he has, maybe there wouldn't be. Why is that, Chris?
Well, I, you know, this may sound sentimental and silly, but I think it's the kindness in his eyes. There was something, whoever he was playing, there was it's a twinkle, and it's also a warmth. And there was also an ability, you know, that there's this interesting story that people, somebody wrote about right after he died, about that famous scene in Charlie and the Willy Wonka, the Charlie and Chocolate Factory movie, when he comes out as Willy Wonka, and he apparently insisted he'd do it this way in order to, otherwise he refused to do the role. He comes out with a stick, and you think he's, you know, needs a stick, and then he does a sort of pratfall and jumps forward. And from that point on, he famously said, nobody knew whether you could trust Willy Wonka. And it was that encapsulated his ability to combine the sweet kindness with the malevolent or the you know, the wildly comedic.
Yeah, that Willy Wonka role is actually one I think I appreciated more as an adult because when you watch it, there is such a masterful balancing of tones between, you know, that charming. It's not just his eyes, by the way. The eyes have a lot of kindness, but so does his voice. He's got this purr of a voice, and so you really trust him and you think he's warm. But there's also this edge in that character of Willy Wonka where he's really, when he yells at Charlie about the gobstopper, which is not in the book, by the way.
Which is very Roald Dahl, though, you know, that frightening. He once made it kinder, but at the same time, he caught that Roald Dahl style in it. Yeah. And he was a writer, too, right? He co-wrote with Mel Brooks, right?
Well, he had the original idea and co-wrote Young Frankenstein, and his big breakthrough. So his first movie was Bonnie and Clyde, 1967, and he was already 34 at that point. He was the young guy in Bonnie and Clyde. And then Producers was a year later. I heard Mel Brooks talking about how, you know, he'd offered it to him a long time ago, but they were waiting to get the funding, and when they finally did, Gene Wilder cried because he never thought they would actually get to do this movie about, you know, with that premise and Springtime for Hitler and everything else. And just the way that he could go from the sort of, you know, likable, mild-mannered guy to those great hysterical, I'm wet and I'm hysterical scenes, is one of the great scenes of all time in comedy. he really sort of could balance all this stuff. And then later he was cast in Blazing Saddles, where originally Gig Young was the Waco kid. Gig Young, ironically or not, the Waco kid is this, you know, alcoholic who has to sort of, you know, get it together to defend this sheriff who was played by Cleavon Little, originally going to be Richard Pryor. But anyway, you know, that was not Gene Wilder's role. It was Gig Young's role, but he was having so many problems with his own drinking and that he had to be removed from that picture. And Mel Brooks called his friend Gene Wilder, and boom, he was there the next day. And he's really just has this great warmth in that role. And then right after that, they did Young Frankenstein, which Gene Wilder had co-written.
So we got a call from Jim, who has an opinion on Gene Wilder's best role. Go ahead. Hey, Jim, welcome. Thanks for calling.
Well, thanks for having me on. Big fan of both you guys. Love your criticism.
Thank you so much.
And, actually, Chris, I also want to thank you for recommending The Flick.
Oh, yeah, great play.
I am a fan of that play, and I know a lot
Annie
of people.
Baker, yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, speaking of flicks, I think a Gene Wilder
nice
film. I think the Gene Wilder film that gets overlooked sometimes. And I just noticed when they put like the top five films up, this one doesn't appear, but Silver Streak.
Oh yeah,
and
Silver Streak was a big one.
Why do you think that?
Well, probably because he's not as crazy in that film. He does get upset when he gets thrown off the train, but other than that, he's kind of playing that Cary Grant North by Northwest.
Right.
Lead with against Joe Clayburgh, and I just thought that was just a terrific movie, and also the chemistry with of course Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder, and I think that was their best film together.
Yeah, well, Silver Streak really established him after he'd done all these Mel Brooks movies, and then he'd done one that he'd written himself and directed, The Adventure of Sherlock Holmes, The Smarter Brother. And this sort of launched the next phase of Gene Wilder's post-Mel Brooks career. Mm. And a lot of it was because his chemistry with Richard Pryor was so wonderful. And again, Richard Pryor was supposed to be the sheriff in Blazing Saddles. Richard Pryor was a co-writer on Blazing Saddles. Warner Brothers would not go for him for a variety of reasons, and they ended up getting Cleavon Little, who worked out just fine and was wonderful. So you finally get them together for Silver Streak. And there's this – I rewatched some of it recently. In the first hour of it, it's pretty slow, but you still like Gene Wilder, so you stick with it. And then when Richard Pryor comes in, then boom, there's all this great chemistry between them. And then they carried that on again in Stir Crazy, which was a hit, and See No Evil, Hear No Evil, which was not so much of a hit. But you sort of had that feeling that playing off of Gene Wilder – he just sort of came across as this genuine, generous guy, and so he made other people look good.
Exactly. Heck, he even made Patrick McGoohan look good. So
he was a bad guy in that movie.
Yeah, he was a bad guy, yeah. The prisoner, yeah.
Well, thanks so much for calling. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead. I just want to say thanks for mentioning Silver Streak, and keep up the good work.
Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for calling, Jim.
Thanks for being on the Nocturnal Journal.
So are you a fan of Silver Streak, Chris Jones?
Yeah.
Have you seen that one?
I saw
that one a couple
one.
Times, like when
it
came
out.
I have
to admit. It's been a long time since I saw it, to be absolutely honest, but I recall it.
Well, that's one of those things where I watched some of it, I don't know, within the last year or so. And again, like comedies of that era are just so much slower than we're used to. But, you know, again, when Richard Pryor comes in, there's just that energy between them. And Richard Pryor has the more funny parts to it, but you stick with it as a story because you believe in Gene Wilder.
So,
but who would you say now would like who is the Gene Wilder of today?
I don't know. We even have it's, you know, he seemed to represent a sort of a gentler time to me. I'm not sure that we really have an equivalent of him. He's also, you know, a classic song and dance man in some ways. You know, what do you think of the argument? You know, some people made the argument that his fatal flaw as an actor in his career trajectory was a desire to play romantic leads, that he wasn't that always happy being a comedian, that he always wanted to play romantic leads, and probably to his detriment. What do you think of that?
Well, and there's that, and also the fact that he wanted to write and direct, and, you know, I think that his track record on that is a little bit spotty.
Yeah.
You know, I think that the romantic lead part that everyone loved him in was that he was the husband of Gilda Radner.
Yeah.
And then, you know,
an equal talent.
Right. Or, you know, I mean, people thought Gilda Radner was. She was fantastic. And, you know, it was another very funny person who he partnered with. And I think if you were with the two of them, you would think she was the funnier person.
Right.
But he was there with her. And, you know, she died of cancer at a relatively young age, and he championed Gilda's Club. And so I think there was a lot. So some of the goodwill for him, I think, also was that. But yeah, I mean, he wrote and directed a movie called World's Greatest Lover, and you know that was after Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother. There's sort of a theme to this, right? Because young Frankenstein is like all these sort of relatives of the famous characters. And he wasn't really that kind of an actor and that kind of a presence. You know, I don't know. Is Ben Stiller sort of a Gene Wilder type? I think Ben Stiller projects more of sort of a neurosis.
Yes, it's more, right.
That sort of thing. There's not, you don't sort of want to, you know, hug him like you did Gene Wilder.
He's of a vanished era, and you know, and it was interesting. You know, he obviously had, you know, he had Alzheimer's, there's something about even the last, and certainly when his family announced his death, there was something about the manner of announcement of his death. Just as something, I think the reason that people reacted so strongly to this is that he was so, there's something so moving about him as a person. And even, you know, I was watching today some interviews with him that he gave, and there's something about his presence in a journalistic setting that was just so deeply moving the whole time. He touched people. He's a rare talent, you know, and there's been only a handful of people in the history of Hollywood who've been able to do that.
Yeah, nobody wanted to think about him sort of suffering through this. And people didn't know also. They didn't know what was going on. The statement from his family was just so lovely also. This statement regarding Gene Wilder from his nephew child, Jordan Walker Perlman. And it goes on for several paragraphs, but right in the middle it says that the decision to wait until this time to disclose his condition wasn't vanity, but more so that the countless young children that would smile or call out to him, "There's Willy Wonka," would not have to be then exposed to an adult referencing illness or trouble and causing delight to travel and travel to worry, disappointment, or confusion. He simply couldn't bear the idea of one less smile in the world.
Well, that, you know, and it's true that successive generations of children discovered him through that film. Even, you know, it's still a film that everybody watches coming to Broadway. The stage version's coming to Broadway
of Willy Wonka.
But no Gene Wilder, sadly.
Is it the stage version of that particular? Because there was the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
It's
that
a combination
Tim Burton
of this,
directed.
It's a combination of the two.
Johnny Depp, and that was the one that was going to be more faithful to the book. And I mean, I remember when I'm just completely dating myself now. Listen, you're listening to an old man on WGN, but I remember that Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory was the first movie I ever went to where I was like, "That's not like the book." And I was offended as a kid that it wasn't named Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, because that's what the book was, and the book's about the kid, so why should the movie be about the adult? But looking back on it, you know, the changes that they made cinematically made sense, and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory didn't, you know, really work as a movie, the Tim Burton one, and this one was much better. You are listening to WGN. We're about to go to commercial break. But it's Mark Caro again with Chris Jones. You're on Nocturnal Journal. We're filling in. We're substitute teaching for Dave Hoekstra. Thank you very much, Dave. We appreciate it. We'll be back in a moment. We'll be talking more about Gene Wilder. If you'd like to call in, 312-981-7200, or send us tweets at Chris Jones Trib or at Mark with a K, Caro, C-A-R-O. On Twitter. Thank you so much. See you in a bit.
You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. The common clay of the New West. You know, morons.
He rode a blazing saddle. He wore a shining star. His job to offer battle.
There we go, Gene Wilder in Blazing Saddles with modern political commentary. He's reassuring Cleavon Little after Cleavon Little has been treated very badly in the town. And he's like, well, you know, they're morons. So anyway, not that I'm implying anything about anyone, but that's one of the elements of Blazing Saddles that kind of holds up interestingly again. And then there's Gene Wilder with that sort of perfect delivery. He doesn't say it in any sort of mean way. He just sort of holds up. I mean, Gene Wilder, we're still talking about him. People are talking about him. You look at his filmography, and he did Stir Crazy in 1980. What is it after Stir Crazy that he even did that people sort of celebrate? I mean, a lot of the stuff, you know, we're talking about is basically from 1967, Bonnie and Clyde, 68 producers, through 1980, Stir Crazy. And after that, you got, you know, Hanky Panky, Woman in Red, Haunted Honeymoon, See No Evil, Hear No Evil, Funny About Love, Another You. He had that show, Something Wilder, which did not last. You know, he was on Will and Grace, and yet there's this reservoir now of good feeling toward this guy for this finite. Like, how do you do that? How does someone just manage to capture that, Chris?
Well,
Jones?
You know, I think one of the great qualities of acting is being in the moment. That is to say, spontaneity, right? Truth, living in the moment, living truthfully in imaginary circumstances. And there's something about Wilder that he was always in the moment. You could imagine if he were here with Mark Caro, Chris Jones on the Nocturnal Journal, his eyes would be dancing, he'd be sparkling, he'd be part of the game, he'd be in the game. There wouldn't be anything manipulative. He would sort of take the moment as it was. And I admired the fact that he didn't necessarily play a fleet of beloved characters. He played some complex characters. But there was something about him that people related to. And there's just, as you say, sometimes when people die, there's a certain small number of people who you really grieve for, even though you only knew them professionally.
Mark Caro here on the Nocturnal Journal with Chris Jones. Mm-hmm. We are subbing for Dave Hoekstra on WGN. Mel Brooks was never as good without Gene Wilder than with Gene Wilder. I mean, I think most people, if you said name the three best Mel Brooks movies, you'd say The Producers, Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, in whichever order you would choose.
Yeah.
But those would be the three, right?
Right.
And if you were going to choose the three best Gene Wilder movies, you might choose those. You might throw in Wonka. You might throw in, you know, one of the ones with Richard Pryor. I mean, obviously, you know, Bonnie and Clyde is a great movie. But
well, Brooks, you know, Brooks was a satirist. I spent a day with Brooks once, and he's a very, very nice guy. But Wilder offered that warmth, that heart.
And in those movies after Young Frankenstein, I mean, when Mel Brooks was starring in High Anxiety, he just didn't have that quality that Gene Wilder did. He was sort of better off on the side, you know, doing the small parts, I think.
We got a call. Let's hear what our listener has to say about Gene Wilder. Hey, you're on the Nocturnal Journal. Oh, maybe we don't. Maybe we don't.
You guys are really, really fantastic, and thank you for doing this show.
We appreciate that.
Sorry, that was me, I admit it. But, you know, sometimes you got to improvise. I was being in the moment, Chris Jones.
Just like Gene Wilder. Mark Caro, we're coming to the end. We only have 5 more minutes of the Nocturnal Journal.
I know, and
how
you know what? It's almost like we've almost like reached the Labor Day weekend of tonight's Nocturnal Journal. Like there are only 2 more days of Labor Day, and then you feel like summer's gone, even though the weather, you know, the season.
I don't know.
I still got a few more weeks.
I find it depressing.
So you're depressed because it's the end of?
Well, it's my birthday next week, and I don't relish my birthday. I find myself, another year older, which I find depressing, and
it's more depressing.
Like going back to work. I've got a lot of work next week. I'm just, and this, I always feel that when you're having fun Labor Day weekend, sometimes there's this twinge of, just a twinge of, you know, pain behind it all. I don't know. I've always felt this way. It's not new for me. This Labor Day weekend thing, I don't know. I always get, it's nice to have the Nocturnal Journal this time, though.
It does. It is. But you know what? It's a glorious weekend, and it's great to be out. And you know what? Weather-wise, I feel like September is the best month in Chicago. It actually is. If you could just sort of get rid of the whole melancholy, the beginning of fall, days are getting shorter, things. September is a wonderful month. And hey, we have a caller. We have Valerie who wants to call in, and we want to talk to Valerie.
Hey, Valerie.
So, Valerie, what do you have to say?
Hi. Good evening.
Hey, hello. Valerie.
I was racking my brain when you asked if there is another comedian or actor who is similar to Gene Wilder, and the only one I could think of is Dick Van Dyke.
No, good choice.
He's someone who also people just love, and when's the last time you saw, you know, a new Dick Van Dyke thing that was really great? He also
exactly.
has a sort of warmth, and there's sort of a poignancy to him as well. I mean, he did have his, you know... His what was the TV series that he was on? Where's the doctor? That's terrible. I shouldn't be asking you this. But Dick Van Dyke, that's a great, and Mel Brooks worked with him too, I think, right?
All right.
Exactly. And it's kind of like a forgotten art or something that these actors today don't have or don't know how to show those the foibles and the shortcomings and the weaknesses as well as their strengths.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about like Jeff Garland or Tim Allen, they all have that really strong sense.
Yeah,
like, I feel like we should be able to think of
a weakness.
I think we should be able to think of like a warm young actor who we say, oh, he has a kind of that Gene Wilder sort of thing. I mean, wouldn't be Shia LaBeouf. You know, Ryan Gosling has his moments, but he's obviously a very intense actor type person too. You know, someone we got to think of this.
We'll think about that. We got another call, Mark, from Jeff.
Let's hear about Jeff.
Let's hear what Jeff has.
Thank
does
you,
Jeff,
Valerie.
Does Jeff have a thought on this? Hey, Jeff.
Hello.
How are you, Jeff? You're on the Nocturnal Journal with Chris and Mark.
Hello.
I'm sorry. It's Joe.
Oh, Joe. Oh, how you doing, Joe?
Well, they spelled your name J-E-F-F, so that's why we were confused.
I might have not enunciated what
that's
I
all right.
told him.
What do you have to say about Mr. Wilder?
This is in regards to Willy Wonka.
Yeah.
I was very fortunate quite a while back to do the tech, to be on the tech end of doing a stage version of the movie script.
Okay.
We got permission from the estate of Ron Dahl. They actually sent us the movie script itself.
Yeah.
With all the notes and everything. And the amount of that Gene Wilder had to do that wasn't in the script in terms of flipping between the madman and the genius and loving the kids and hating the kids and none of that, you know, none of the emotion of all that was there in the script. It was all what he felt he needed to do at that time.
Right. Yeah. No, it's a tricky. Fantastic. What he did to that movie. There's just such a great range, and that's why I think that's why that movie holds up because. You know, again, it's sort of a weird little movie, but he just anchors that thing. And I think that he actually sort of earned, you know, getting top billing in the title, even though it really should be Charlie's Story. Thanks so much for calling.
Thanks, Joe.
Joe. Come on, Chris. And we have to go to a commercial on Nocturnal Journal with Mark Caro and Chris Jones. We'll be back in a moment.